and I'm a postdoc in applied physics, person Seth Shepherd. And I'm very pleased to introduce today's speaker, Thomas Peter, from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Switzerland, Zurich. Thomas Peter has been full professor for abstract chemistry at the Institute for Atmospheric and Climate Science at ETH since January 1999. He received his PhD in physics from the University in Munich, Germany, in 1988 for work in the field of heavy ion-induced inertial confinement fusion. In 1990, he changed research field, joining the Department for Atmospheric Chemistry at the Max Planck Institute of Chemistry in Mainz. There, he became the leader of the group for heterogeneous chemistry. Became the leader of the group for heterogeneous chemistry in microphysics of atmospheric aerosol in 1995. He was a coordinator of the Polgas aerosol project within the German Ocean Research Program, a member of the steering committee of the high-flying aircraft Geophysica. He's a co-author of many international scientific assessments on the development of the stratospheric ozone layer, and since 1997, a member of the steering committee of the World Climate Research Program, SPARC. So with this group, Thomas Peter performs fundamental research on chemical reactions and physical processes of aerosol particles involving both experiments and chemical physical models. Their studies led to major advances in the understanding of formation of polar stratospheric clouds, which are responsible for the spring ozone depletion in polar regions. They further participate in a number of aircraft and balloon campaigns, as well as long-term measurements, including the world's longest ozone time series in Arosa, Switzerland also. So now I'm looking forward to your presentation. Come and stay yours.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here and speak to you. I'm very pleased to see that also on a Friday, relatively late in the game, so many people still find their way to such a seminar. I had myself forgotten what's all in my CV, but one particular aspect, Michaela, forgot to note. When I came to ETH 7 years ago, she was my first PhD student. And that was a great start. So thank you very much. So I will talk about what one might call the high supersaturation puzzle. It's concerned with these sort of clouds that you see there, cirrus clouds, and what we recently have found that around those clouds, the air can become supersaturated with respect to ice to much, much higher levels than one could physically understand and then seems to be acceptable. And that also within these clouds, supersaturation quite often is found to stay high, and one doesn't understand why the water vapor molecules are not simply condensing on the ice surfaces. So this work comes from 2 months of discussion when Marsha Baker from Seattle had visited us earlier this year in Zurich. Thomas Grob from Bielefeld University participated in this, and then from the institute I'm working at, Claudia Marcolli, Peter Spichtinger, and Thierry Corti. And it all can be summarized, if you like, with a sentence down here, that the discovery of massive supersaturations with respect to ice in upper tropospheric cloud-free air and also within the clouds themselves calls into question our understanding of the physics of cloud formation. In this talk, I will not offer a single explanation for the phenomenon. I will rather discuss our present state of being puzzled. So it's about this quantity here, S, the ratio of the water partial pressure over the vapor pressure over ice, which you also might want to express when you take the multiply both quantities or divide both pressures by the temperature, as the number density of water molecules in the air divided by what would be there in the air if it was in equilibrium over ice. Partial pressure divided by vapor pressure. If this quantity is larger than ice, larger than one, the ice particles are expected to grow. One would say this is then supersaturated air. When it's equal to one, the ice particles are in equilibrium with the gas phase. Smaller than one, subsaturated, the ice will slowly evaporate. Another notation in the more meteorological community is RHI, the relative humidity with respect to ice, but it's the same as S, and while S is a number, RHI is often expressed as a percentage, but that's the only difference. An important quantity in here is the vapor pressure over ice, which often can be simply expressed as an Arrhenius-type expression. So it has an E to the minus constant over T, temperature dependence, and that constant B up here will later come up again and play a role in what I will be telling you. Two questions are central to our understanding of ice cloud formation, and they concern nucleation and uptake kinetics of the water molecules. Question one, at what saturation ratio S do we expect ice to nucleate? Well, clearly you cannot go arbitrarily high in supersaturation. Eventually, ice will nucleate. And as you know from Wilson's cloud chamber, even when there is no pre-existing aerosol, eventually you will get ice formation or particle formation. Second, once then the ice has formed after this step, how rapidly do we expect the ice to grow and hence the supersaturation in the air to be decreasing, to be approaching equilibrium going to one? So this cartoon shows you, if you like, the present state. The green trajectory up here shows what the normal textbook knowledge would be, and the two other examples show the puzzle. Imagine there's an air parcel being lifted in the air. When it's lifted, it gets under lower pressure, therefore it cools adiabatically, and in that cooling air mass, then eventually, namely at this point here marked by this yellow star, when S goes beyond a certain threshold, nucleation sets in. So we get tiny ice crystals. When it then further cools, these ice crystals will further grow and eventually become so large that they might fall out. If beyond that point of nucleation it does not further cool, the ice crystals will nevertheless grow because there is a supersaturation. And because of that, they will grow by already until the gas phase is depleted in water. So that would be the normal case, and it's depicted down here by this green curve. You enhance the supersaturation, you nucleate, you might enhance it another little bit because you keep cooling. However, then the ice particles will eventually take over, deplete the gas phase, and therefore S goes to one. What has been observed is very similar developments of air masses, possibly. However, nucleation doesn't set in for whatever reason. So the saturation ratio increases to high values. This cartoon says something higher than two. And if a year ago or so you would have told me, is that possible, I would have right away said, no, not at all, never. Because we are really deeply convinced that above this threshold of 1.6, 60% of supersaturation, ice nucleation must happen. There are observations where it doesn't. And the second case here, the orange line, or the third case, if you like, shows another case where the ice nucleation does happen. However, then the ice is there, and it doesn't eat up the water vapor. The water vapor doesn't want to condense. And honestly, I'm not sure which of these two cases I'm more surprised about, but either of them is not easily to be understood. What would be the normal situation that we would imagine? Well, for example, if there is a mountain and you have air flowing above the mountain, then you get what is called lee waves, and then in the lee of this mountain, the air might become cold, and you might get the formation of a cloud. And let me see whether I can show you a little movie made by Peter Spichtinger on that. Oh yeah, I should stop that for a moment. What you see here, he started that airflow when the flow field was still very laminar and the lee waves have not yet developed. And he looks at the layer of supersaturated air coming in, and that supersaturation here, the yellow color, is about 10% of supersaturation. And when it becomes dark red, as here, then we reach about 150 to 160% of relative humidity, and then the ice nucleation sets in. You see here this first little white spot saying there is ice. And now we watch that continuing. So downstream, you now see, okay, the cloud develops. It's so ice in here, and inside the cloud, you see, the traditional picture is, and that is what that model is doing, the supersaturation falls down again close to one, yellowish to greenish color. Upstream and downstream of the cloud, on the other hand, where ice did not nucleate because the critical supersaturation wasn't reached, the supersaturation remains. And then we can continue here, and you see this first cloud in this development is now advectively carried downstream. And now, if I do that a bit quicker, you see how the lee waves are actually building up. And now we get a stationary cloud. So this cloud kind of is fixed to this mountain here, stays there. And you see that how the model says, and all the theoretical knowledge that we have, the microphysics in that model says, that where we have the ice particles, just a few minutes after the ice nucleated here, and a few kilometers downstream, very rapidly we get S equal to 1, and you have that C-shaped function where ice was either had not yet formed or is still too small, where you still have the supersaturation. Okay, you see that here as well. That is the normal picture. Here is now the surprising data. I show here in A, again, the normal case, the theory. This shows ice saturation ratio as a function of temperature. So we expect clouds around S equal 1. That's that bluish region here. Much below, the ice will evaporate, and much above it will grow. So here we will have either clear sky or rapid growth. Then there are these two lines here for certain aerosol sizes, 5 micron and 50 nanometer particles. So if we have 5 micrometer or 50 nanometer aqueous aerosol particles, and we cool them down and supersaturate them, then these lines say this is the threshold where the ice formation will set in, homogeneously, without having an ice nucleus, just inside these liquid droplets. So we think these little droplets, we cannot supercool more than these black lines. So when air goes in vigorous upward motion into this region up here, then it will immediately, spontaneously nucleate ice, and there will be vigorous ice growth. And then there is another bluish line here, which says this is the supercooled water equilibrium curve. So beyond that line, even liquid droplets are expected to form. Okay, so that's the textbook knowledge. Now we go into an aerosol chamber experiment, and we look at what people have done in large aerosol chambers. That is, from an 80 cubic meter aerosol chamber, they took ammonium sulfate liquid aerosols, aqueous ammonium sulfate aerosols, cooled them down, and yes, exactly where also the theory, which is based on laboratory experiments, looking at emulsions, looking at little aerosol droplets in particle traps, it coincides with that prediction here at this point, ice nucleation sets in, and despite the fact that there's further cooling inside that aerosol chamber, cloud chamber, very rapidly the saturation breaks down and goes down, and then eventually, because the whole ensemble warms up again, also evaporates again. There are exceptions. The same authors down here have taken soot particles, which were massively coated with organic carbon, with organic molecules. And these soot particles seem to be invisible to the water molecules. So despite the fact that you have a volume with lots of aerosols inside, these highly organic aerosols are not seen by the water vapor. They aren't accepted. They are completely hydrophobic, and you indeed can drive down the supersaturation very high. This experiment here in the cloud chamber reminds of the first puzzle, which is observed during a campaign, which we call the Pre-AVI campaign in Costa Rica a few years ago, where on the U.S.-American WB-57 aircraft, measurements were made, and you see here the aircraft flies into a layer which supercools massively without any observation of ice formation. It even goes higher beyond that upper curve, beyond that upper edge of the graph here. And then D, the second riddle, in cloud contrail observations, in another campaign, the crystal phase campaign, but the same equipment and same aircraft, in cirrus measurements, the black points here, and contrail measurements, the green points, show large ice surface areas, however, persistent supersaturation. Let me look in a bit more detail at those observations. So this is the first case where high supersaturation was observed without any ice formation. And that was when the aircraft basically was coming down to land at the end of a campaign, flying in the tropopause region. We are in the tropics here, or in the near tropics. And it flies in the tropopause region here around 17 kilometers through a layer which shows these massive supersaturations. These blue curves here are the ones which I just explained. They are based on, here called COP threshold, based on our current knowledge where ice formation must set in on the pre-existing aerosols, but it doesn't. Along with this observation, we see that there were only 100 particles per cubic centimeter pre-existing aerosol particles. That's a very low number density for atmospheric, from an atmospheric point of view. However, it's still high enough, and although also the size of these particles is high enough, that one for sure would expect ice formation. This was the other case, the crystal phase experiment, published by Gao et al. In Science 2004. What this shows is about 4,000 data points clustered in 5K intervals here in these black dots with error bars. The error bars just show the data variability, or the atmospheric variability, actually. And it again shows relative humidity with respect to ice as a function of temperature. And as you see, over a very wide range of temperatures below 230 K, there is supersaturation predominantly. And then below 203 or so Kelvin, there's an additional increase here. And back here, there are many contrail measurements also. Very, very high number densities and surface areas, and we don't understand why it doesn't condense. It also is not the case that there are patches in the atmosphere where you have a patch which is maybe 10 meters large, which is highly supersaturated. Next to that, a patch which is not supersaturated, and the aircraft is flying through that, or maybe 100-meter patches. This seems to be not the case. Rather, as you see from this plot here, showing in green, again, relative humidity with respect to ice as a function of time, and you see here here about the 100% line, which I forgot to properly mark. And you see periods of 1 hour length and of 1.5 hour length here, where always it's supersaturated along those flight legs. Is it a meteorological curiosity, and why at all should we be worried about that? And I only give you a glimpse of why that is of interest. When you look at the tropics, then there is what is called the Brewer-Dobson circulation. The air rises in the tropics and is shifted towards the mid-latitudes and the polar regions. So the stratosphere, which is the layer higher than, say, 15 kilometers, is humidified by the air, which starts climbing in the tropics and then going northward and southward. What has been observed, at least by a few instruments, seems to be a massive enhancement of stratospheric humidity over the last few decades. There's lots of controversy about this. However, there is some data which is based on data as those we are discussing here inside the cirrus cloud, referring to stratospheric humidities, which say that over the last 50 years, maybe there were something like 1% increased humidity per year. And from that, you can easily calculate that if this is true at all, it might not be true, or it might be that it is not true, I should say. But if this is true at all, then the stratosphere would have doubled in humidity over the last half a century. This would have important effects. The stratosphere might cool a little bit, and it would chemically be different from a more dry stratosphere. Another issue is, if there is this supersaturation before that air here actually climbs up into the stratosphere, then, of course, this air will take more water vapor with it into the stratosphere and will allow less cloud formation. So the effect by itself will decrease the tropical cloudiness, possibly, and therefore have a climate effect, possibly. Okay, so I'm now again changing gears. I'm going back one step. Let's look at the basics. What do we know? Well, there is a liquid, a stable liquid. There is a melting point temperature, normally when it's water, 0 degrees Celsius. Below it, crystals are stable. However, as you know, that's not the whole picture. Rather, when we take little droplets, we can cool them quite massively. We can supercool them. They stay liquid, and at only at some very low temperature, they freeze homogeneously. Or if they have an ice nucleus with them, that might happen at a somewhat higher temperature, but still much, much lower than 0 degrees Celsius. We have, in atmospheric sciences, in physical chemistry, made some quite prominent progress in the last 6 or so years in understanding the freezing of supercooled aqueous solutions. This is shown in this diagram here. What we have learned is that if you take a bunch of chemical species, all those down here, and there are many, many which are atmospherically relevant, like ammonium sulfate or bisulfate, sulfuric acid, but there are also very many which are not so relevant for the atmosphere, urea, glucose, and so on. And so you take aqueous solutions of these species, and then you can look at the melting point curves that are these black dots here as a function of concentration of these species down here. You can do the same for the freezing point curves for, say, micrometer-sized droplets. And you see a considerable scatter. So, for example, an aqueous sulfuric acid solution might be this one curve here in melting point and this one curve here in freezing point. If we now take the same data and we plot them as a function of water activity, then the miracle happens. While all those melting point curves based on theory, need to collapse to one line, so that is not surprising, the freezing points do as well. And that's interesting, and we understand that at least a little bit, because we know that the water activity, which is basically the relative humidity over water, is related to the structure of the water molecules inside these solutions, and there have been neutron scattering experiments showing that when the structure is one in one particular coordination, then that means this solution is particularly suited to form ice. And this structure corresponds to one water activity. So water activity, not molality or whatever measure of concentration, is the quantity with respect to which we want to quantify these solutions. And this has happened here, and these neutron scattering experiments then show that when you look at different solutions with different solutes but same water activity, then they behave very similarly. And then there is a pressure analog to which I won't say anything here. Down here we have no man's land, so we would think in this region we cannot go because the ice must form. We cannot have solutions down here. But we have the metastable solution in this region and the stable liquid up here. So we think we understand all that pretty well. When you take a trajectory in the atmosphere which cools down and the relative humidity goes up, and the water activity goes up, then eventually one makes ice, and one has the phase diagrams which show that. We understand all that, so what's wrong? We even would say we know that with an increase that shows ice saturation ratio as a function of temperature, and with an increase in the saturation ratio of 5%, because of the steepness of the nucleation rate as a function of relative humidity, the characteristic freezing time shrinks by a factor of 10 to the 6. So there is a very, very sharp temperature where we expect the ice to nucleate. So what does that mean for the observations? Well, it means that here, when the aircraft saw this air, which was cooling, as ice getting higher and higher, then about here where it cuts those two lines for these pre-existing particles, we would expect a characteristic nucleation time of around 1 minute, and then we would expect ice to occur. Here, this is 0.3 higher. It's already much, much, much lower than 1 second. And up here, it's ridiculous how short the time should be. So we do not understand this. Do we understand the next thing? How does water now condense on the ice particles? Well, that there is a textbook description of that. We know that the density of water molecules in the gas phase as a function of time follows this law. This change as a function of time is powered by the difference between the partial pressure and the vapor pressure, if you like. Then it's proportional to the radius of the particles. The larger the ice particles is, the more chance the water molecules in the gas phase have to actually condense. So clearly, this will go faster. It's proportional to the number of ice particles. The more they are, the faster it goes. Very simple. It's proportional to a modified diffusion constant. I'll come to that in a moment. So the inverse of this prefactor here is a characteristic time describing the condensation. So after this characteristic time, we expect the supersaturation to decrease by a factor E. This D star here is called the modified diffusion constant. It describes the resistance of the gas phase to the water molecules to actually condense onto the ice, but it also includes a limitation by mass accommodation called alpha. So a water molecule might actually reach the ice surface, knock at it, but it isn't let in for whatever reason. Maybe because it came with the wrong hydrogen molecule, hydrogen atom to the surface or something. So we, and this is a typo, should have 2m. So if we look at what that means, because of that product r times n, if we you get these hyperbolic functions here. And you see that with, say, 10 ice particles per cubic centimeter, 10 micrometer large, we would expect that within 10 seconds, the supersaturation decreases to 1 over E of its original value. And when it's much less ice down here, we maybe have 10 minutes. If we now look at the crystal phase campaign data, they are typically inside these cirrus clouds in this box. So we would expect that between 5 seconds and, say, 1 minute, most of the supersaturation should go away. Now, of course, there is one other thing. The particles might sediment. We may also take this term here into account. We can describe this as well. But more important is, how could the supersaturation be maintained? So when the water condenses on the ice, the supersaturation goes down. However, if you now envisage this to happen in an air parcel, which is at the same time is lifted and therefore cooling, then this might balance each other, right? And we can describe that. I'm not going into details here. We have a lapse rate. It's proportional to the upwelling velocity. And then there's a temperature function. And there's, again, that B, which we saw early on in the Arrhenius expression for the vapor pressure. It's all classical physics. And we get another characteristic time here, a cooling time scale. So we can take these two things together, the decrease by condensation and the increase of the saturation ratio by lifting air. And we can put that together, and we come to such formula here. And if we go further and simplify that a little bit, a very, very simple description comes out. The steady-state supersaturation, steady-state because you have condensation, which lowers the supersaturation. At the same time, you have the lifting of the air parcel, which enhances the supersaturation. And this balances each other when this is equal to the upwelling velocity W divided by the radius of the particles divided by their number density. And it happens that when you normalize these quantities in this atmospherically nice way, that the prefactor is very, very close to 1. So we have indeed a very simple description here. So we can plot these curves, again, as function of number density and radius. Each of this curve is an equilibrium curve for steady state. In this case here, steady state saturation 1.3. For example, again, if we have 20 micron ice particles and we have only about 0.2 or 0.3 per cubic centimeter of these ice particles in an air mass, which is lifted by 1 meter per second, then this is a steady state S. But please tell me, what will the pilot tell you when you are sitting in an aircraft and you fly through an air mass where you have 1 meter per second upwelling? Fasten seatbelts, please. So this is already a pretty large upwelling velocity. It's convective. It normally also, there's a jitter to it. When you get into a thunderstorm, you might, of course, get into a 10 or 20 meter per second upward channel. And then when you are standing, you are within less than a second flat on the ground. And it also usually then, because the aircraft flies through, only happens for a short moment. But there might be such channels. I think, looking at the time, I jump across that. You want me to stop by about 5 o'clock, right? Okay. So that was just about how that picture is changed by sedimentation. It's not so important because the data that we will further look at seem to be unaffected by sedimentation because the crystals are too small to actually sediment very much. Apologies. We now can look a bit further at that. What does that mean? What's the traditional microphysical understanding then? This is again such a plot showing number density of ice, showing radius of the particles, and now you have various curves here. The blue curves, both are the steady state curves for 0.1 meter per second upwelling. So that's 10 centimeters per second is the air going up. That's relatively mild. And what I have here, you saw that alpha before, that's the mass accommodation coefficient of water on ice. Clearly, if the mass accommodation of water on ice is not equal to 1, 1 would mean each water molecule getting in contact with the ice surface stucks and is absorbed and built into the ice matrix and has condensed. If it's only 0.1, then only 10, each 10th water molecule is doing that, and the other 9 are sent back into the gas phase. And this is, of course, another thing I'm telling you here. We are not sure how large is the mass accommodation coefficient of water molecules on ice. We have laboratory experiments on that, but it's not at all easy to figure that out. Again, had you asked me 1-2 years ago, I would have. I belong to those who said, well, water on ice has a mass accommodation coefficient of 1. I'm no longer that sure about it. So you see here these two blue curves, and that spans that region between mass accommodation 0.1 to 1 with low upwelling velocities. You have the two green curves, again, alpha 0.1, alpha 1, with 1 meter per second upwelling, and you have the two red curves showing alpha equal 1 and 0.1 with 10 meters per second. Now, this is really a brutal upward motion. Again, we look at where are those data that I showed you. Well, they are here. And they would correspond to 10 meters per second upwelling. Now, clearly, I hope I told you this is not possible, 10 meters per second. You saw those measurements showing over 1 hour supersaturation. Basically, that would mean that within 1 hour with 10 meters per second upwelling, this cloud would have to go up 36 kilometers in the atmosphere. That's not the case. The crystal phase data could be explained assuming strong updrafts but low mass accommodation. But from how I tell it to you, I already indicate I'm not believing in that. If the supersaturation was only 1.1, then it looks a bit more easy to understand in terms of traditional physics, but it seems to be also not really a good perspective. What are the explanations? And presently, there are no explanations. There are only speculations. Well, the first point is, how good are the data, really? It's not a piece of cake to measure water vapor up there. What are the potential out-of-cloud effects? Well, if the atmosphere was equal to Wilson's cloud chamber and there were no pre-existing aerosols, well, yeah, okay, then we could supercool quite massively. Is there an underestimated vapor pressure of supercooled water? If that were the case, the supersaturation would set in, the threshold for nucleation would be only at higher relative humidities. Is there what is termed surface nucleation? Here's the next interesting thing for a general physics audience. When a water droplet freezes, we don't know where the freezing starts. Does it start at the surface? And does the surface of that droplet play a special role for the moment of nucleation? Or does it happen inside the droplet? Hence, is it a volume or a surface proportional quantity. If it's surface nucleation which governs, which we don't know, then if at the surface lots of organic molecules are sitting, they might crucially hinder nucleation. It's very speculative. Could mesoscale temperature fluctuations matter? Could it be that there is subresolution patchiness? Could HNO3 deposition on ice be an aspect which blocks the growth sites on the ice crystal? Could there be intrinsic limitations on growth of ice, basically low mass accommodation? Then there's cubic ice, a very important aspect. The atmosphere does not only contain hexagonal ice, it also contains cubic ice. However, we usually interpret it in terms of hexagonal ice. If all the ice up there was cubic ice or a large fraction of it, then its vapor pressure would be higher than that of hexagonal ice. That would be a nice explanation for these supersaturations. However, the effect seems to be not high enough, not large enough. Or could it actually even also be that overpopulated, high, hot water molecules in the gas phase, because of interactions with photons, make it impossible for these water molecules to actually be attached to the ice surface? I now should really hurry up. So how good are the data? There's support from Europe for these observations, which so far as I explained them to you were mainly American. These are Geophysica and Learjet measurements performed during a number of mid-latitude and tropical European campaigns. This plot is courtesy of Martina Kramer in Jülich. And it shows the ice water content as a function of temperature. Martina took these data and constructed, in a climatological sense, if you like, number density times radius of the ice particles from that. And that is the quantity, as I showed you, which determines how quickly the water is actually condensing on the ice. She took these climatological values, these mean R times N, and here looks at a case of 1 meter per second upwelling velocity, and also plotted, as we are now used to it, relative humidity with respect to ice as a function of temperature. These are all the data. I must say I find them very interesting because also the Geophysica sees extremely high supersaturations. They are all inside zeros. However, if we now look where the crystal phase data are from the American campaign, they are down here. Martina says, well, maybe if the particles have 20 microns in radius, then the mean R times N gives this steady state S curve. And all the points are below that, so maybe one can understand it in terms of traditional microphysics. I would argue this is probably not the full picture. We cannot just look at the mean R times N. We also need to look at the maximum, which can be derived from the same ice water content I showed you before. And if we do that, well, this curve is much less, makes us much less hopeful that we will understand all those massive supersaturations. And also, she assumed a very high upwelling again. So over an hour, these clouds would have to rise by about 4 kilometers. Again, quite unlikely. So I would rather interpret this as not the same, but a very similar picture to what I showed you before. Then there's balloon data. You could say, well, maybe it is related to the fact that when you fly with an aircraft through these cirrus clouds with 200 meters per second, then it's very difficult to measure water vapor. Maybe we take a bit more time, we fly with a balloon. Very similar picture, on the other hand. You see here these individual paths. So here, obviously, the balloon dove through a very cold layer, and again showing relative humidity with respect to ice as a function of air temperature. Again, here showing the ice freezing curve and the saturation line with respect to supercooled water. And again, very similar results as we saw with the aircraft data. Holger Thermel, who gave me these plots, they are still unpublished, also compared his balloon measurements with the aircraft data that I showed you. And there are two different aircraft instruments here. One is the Harvard Lyman Alpha instrument, and the other one is the JPL tunable diode laser absorption instrument. And as you see, at high altitudes and low temperatures, the aircraft instruments are always higher than the balloon, quite a bit. I find that a bit disheartening and discouraging that the discrepancies are so large. I can say that because I'm stepping in on no one's toes, since I'm a modeler or a theoretician. So the conclusion from my perspective, how good are the data? Well, the balloon-borne data are significantly lower than the aircraft-borne ones. The aircraft-borne data show significant discrepancies with respect to each other, which I just showed you. However, all the data sets show very large supersaturations exceeding the homogeneous freezing limits and at times even exceeding pure liquid water saturation. And they all show significant persistent supersaturation inside clouds. I could have come here and told you, well, there is that supersaturation and I believe in it. The fact that I dwell on that point so long is that I started 2 years or 3 years ago looking at these data, and my original response was the data is worth nothing. However, I'm now convinced the data is worth quite a bit, and we really see something up there which we do not fundamentally understand. I jump across that. So what other explanations do we have? Potential out-of-clouds effects, potential in-cloud effects. I now go through that very quickly. Lack of pre-existing aerosols. To make a long story short, well, modeling as well as general understanding tells us the atmosphere is not Wilson's cloud chamber. We cannot arbitrarily make number densities and sizes of aerosols small and smaller and smaller. We would need to make them very small to truly suppress nucleation. That seems to be not an explanation. Underestimated vapor pressure of supercooled water, that is an important thing. I mean, outside of ice clouds, the determination of the relative humidity at which ice nucleation occurs depends also on the saturation vapor pressure of supercooled water, which has to be extrapolated for use below 200 K, and I think the 8 is a citation of Murphy and Korb, possibly leading to errors of up to 20%. That is a possibility. However, when I talk to these authors, they say, well, the data would allow for 20%. However, many laboratory experiments then should give us indication that these 20% are really there. So based on those and on the cloud chamber experiments, they themselves think it's probably not 20%, it's less. And then it does not at all suffice to explain what we see. Here I'm back to this very interesting hypothesis. If water-rich aerosols are covered by organic surfactants, prerequisite one, and if nucleation really starts at the surface and not in the volume of a droplet, prerequisite two, then there might be a chance to explain these observations. Because then maybe up there we have all these little aqueous droplets, but they are all covered with organics, and they are not visible to the water vapor. However, evidence for surface nucleation in itself is controversial. I mean, here's a classic physics problem, which I find very interesting, which we do not have any true understanding of. Where does nucleation start? And furthermore, it's not known how likely it is that up there, organics will always cover those surfaces. I find also this hypothesis not very likely. In-cloud effects controlled by ice nuclei. You can imagine situations where you have ice nuclei. They nucleate ice, but you only have one per cubic meter or so. They pull down the S a little bit, but then it cannot condense further because there are too few of them, and a general state of supercooling remains. Again, I do not believe that. These few particles will then grow very large. They will fall out relatively quickly. I do not see how this could be persistent, this effect. Mesoscale temperature fluctuations, that's something I myself had looked into, and I plotted this plot, which I know I'm running out of time to explain, so I won't. If you have temperature oscillations, then the nonlinearity in the temperature dependence of the Clausius-Clapeyron equation might cause an average supersaturation. However, average does not mean persistent. Rather, you would have relatively large regions, supercooled, undercooled, and so on. And when you fly through, you see an average supersaturation. But that is not what has been observed. This is an interesting thing. I took this picture when my family wanted to have dinner with me at the evening 2 weeks ago above Zurich. And you see here these cirrocumulus undulatus, I think they are called, middle-high cirrus clouds, and you see patchiness there all over the place. And every one of us has observed it, right? When you fly in an aircraft and you look out, then sometimes it is as if someone had a shutter up there switching on and off the light. And when you look at this patchiness, besides the fact that you see lots of nice waves here, the large ones, but then also look here at the tiny ones in between. And when you now think that most of our measurements are averaged over at least 1 second, then this is how far the aircraft is flying. And you average over all these on and offs here. So that might be an explanation. If you have patches which are not icy and other patches which are icy, then the icy patches might be at saturation 1. And there is no riddle and no puzzle. And those which are not icy are supercooled and supersaturated, but just ice didn't form. If you average over that, it looks as if you were in cloud and supercooled. We need other experiments to really look closely at time resolution. HNO3 has been suggested to block the growth sites on ice. Since I ran out of time, I go across that. The mass accommodation coefficient of ice, here you see the difficulties of laboratory experiments. Lots of scatter. However, indication that, yes, it might be as low as 0.1 and not equal to 1. That's a possibility. Cubic ice. Interesting. Cubic ice has probably 10% higher vapor pressure than hexagonal ice. So 10% we might explain, but it's unlikely to be much higher, and it will not explain those 30 or 40% seen here. And finally, and I end with this, there is a hypothesis by Adrian Tuck expressed in a paper a year ago in the Faraday discussions. An overpopulated tail of high-velocity molecules in atmospheric probability distribution functions will also affect the access of condensable vapors to particle surfaces, particularly in the case of water, because that's very light and might therefore be very hot. Calculations over vapor of vapor flux to ice crystals, for example, in polar stratosphere clouds or high cirrus, could incur substantial error by using the traditional diffusion description, which I basically used in what I described to you. However, I'm asking, isn't this in contrast to many laboratory experiments that we are doing when we have a cold ice surface and the rest of the volume of the chamber is at room temperature and no laboratory physicist cares about that? We simply assume that the molecules in a Knudsen chamber hit the ice surface and behave as if they had been as cold as the ice itself. So I'm not sure about that. I summarize that here again, and I jump across that. The way forward, I think we need a workshop where only the most dedicated persons are called together to look at this. We need a dedicated instrument intercomparison, for example, in the cloud chamber and laboratory investigations, also concerning the impurities on ice. And I thank you very much for your attention. it might be related to each other. Then on the other hand, for example, if you ask someone like Thomas Korb, he's certainly more excited about the 240% relative humidity outside of clouds, because he would say, I never believed that. So this is a point where people still, I mean, lots of colleagues think the measurements have a problem. Yeah, but how is, that's a good point, but how do you want to fly during 1 or 1.5 hours with an aircraft through regions which persistently show that supersaturation? I can only explain that if over that entire period of time there would be this upwelling motion. Who? But then you are making up a picture where you would have to convince me that that isn't a fantasy, namely that by pure chance in these experiments we flew with both the European aircraft, the balloon, all three of them, and the American aircraft along the phases in gravity wave fields, which by chance always developed this supersaturation just at the spot where the aircraft was. Isn't that extremely unlikely?
What fraction of measurements are you seeing?
Well, up there in the upper tropical tropopause layer, a relatively large fraction.
Then doesn't that raise another question? Because I thought that there was, you know, in fact, by Stefan Fuglestad, the idea is that we more or less can account for the water vapor observed in the stratosphere just a few percent.
Yeah. Yeah.
That would seem to imply that although this is very interesting, that it can't be a dominant factor in the water.
And that is what Stefan Füglisal and many colleagues are actually thinking. For the others in the audience who might not know about that, if you take our weather prediction model fields of atmospheric temperatures and you let air parcels along trajectories powered by those fields from these models develop in and go through the tropical tropopause, then you can calculate that when these air parcels eventually are in the stratosphere, they have approximately the correct humidity as they should have and is observed. However, it could of course be that the temperatures which do not catch the small scale, for example, are that the minima of these temperatures are still too high in the model, and that by chance this being too high is compensated by the necessary supersaturation. And therefore this is difficult to rule that out.
But the error bars are still very big.
Yeah, wouldn't that also be somewhat accidental?
What do you mean, Norm? Accidental? Yes.
And we observe using those in transporting parcels with the wind.
Yes.
They enter the stratosphere at S equal 1.
That is how Stefan and also I myself previously calculated that,
that
yes?
That really means that in the clouds that are around, S is much greater than 1, but the temperature is much lower.
Yes. Now, of course. Well, much lower. Much lower doesn't mean 10K lower, right? Much lower just means... For S to be 2.5, I would think something like maybe 3 kelvins. Yeah. That would have to be consistently the case. That it would have to be consistently the case that the minima in the temperature have been misjudged by that amount. But at the same time, of course, the maxima could have been misjudged by the same amount, just that we don't care, because we don't care about warm temperatures. We only care about the minimum, right? So it wouldn't be a systematic bias. It need not necessarily be a systematic bias, which seems to be what you are getting at. Yes. By 1, 2K. No, not all the time. Just in the moment when the air parcel reaches the minimum. While at other periods, when you look at a Lagrangian perspective, at other times it might actually be too warm than reality of that air parcel. But then it doesn't matter anyway, that's what I'm saying. Because if it is too warm or much too warm, doesn't matter, because in that moment no cloud will form and it won't contribute to the dehydration process.
I'm a bit concerned about the way how you grow the time of condensation or time of phase relaxation through this equation.
Yes. Oh, of course, but that is what I meant to say. When I showed that first picture, maybe I do not understand what you now are saying. When I showed this, where I actually showed times, that would correspond to the case when the air is not upwelling, right? But when I now switch on the upwelling with a W there, then I calculated the steady state S. So you have condensation on the particles, which is balanced by the additional cooling. And you come to this expression.
This term is missing in this equation as well. Term related to velocity
should be in the... Say again, which term is missing where?
There is a missing term here.
Here's a missing term.
Yeah, right, it's steady state equation.
Which missing term? Yes. 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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So there will be a term in denominator related to proportional to velocity.
To what velocity?
Velocity, updraft velocity.
Up in the denominator also. Well, how about if we talk afterwards about that?
I have another comment regarding cubic ice. Cubic ice was hunted for this for years, and using CPR installed on board for different airplanes. And so far, you don't have any evidence for that.
Well, then there are other people who say we have indeed looked at images out there, and we see it much more often than we would have dreamed about. Yeah, but I mean, you might be right, and I wasn't claiming it's cubic ice. And even if it were cubic ice, indication is that it could explain only a minor fraction of the observed supersaturation.
And one more comment about this difference between balloon bond form level.
Mm-hmm.
Mirror
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you look at the equation of a growth of bias, in order to grow a layer of bias on the surface of mirror, that's the way how a chilled mirror at the Gromyko works, you need tens of minutes. So it means that the response time of this hygrometer is huge compared to those
But this hygrometer used here is not one which is not a classical one which evaporates the entire ice layer and then lets it rebuild again, but rather one which makes the ice layer to be of constant thickness, and they measure that constant thickness. And the balloon is Holger, with Holger Firmel's.
Sir, can I interrupt you here? Can you call it out? I think that's the speaker again for his.
Thank you.